Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. Stay ahead of all the big games in the best league in the world, the Premier League. With the latest odds, form guides, expert opinions and more, the fans are the players at Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com, 18 plus, begambleaware.org, T's and C's apply.
Welcome to Upfront with Les Ferdinand and me, Sam Matterface. This is the show that takes you into the world of the number nine, the centre forward, the goal getter. We try and find out what it takes to be a top flight striker.
Now here goes Ferdinand! Ferdinand in the clear! Les Ferdinand does the business once again!
We'll discuss their career defining goals, their ideal strike partner, and if it's simply about being in the right place at the right time.
And Les Ferdinand, one of the most prolific goal scorers in the Premier League, was in the right place at the right time to nick it home.
You're listening to Upfront with Les Ferdinand and me, Sam Matterface, on TalkSport. 215 goals in 523 games, a star for Queen's Park Rangers, Newcastle and Spurs, a Turkish Cup winner, a Football League Cup winner, a twice runner-up in the Premier League, a member of the Premier League 100 Club, the scorer of the 10,000th goal in Premier League history and part of the most frightening partnership ever seen on this shore. I don't suppose I'm supposed to use the prefix, but I'm going to anyway. Hello, Sir Les Ferdinand. How are you?
Hi, Sam. I'm very well, thanks. Not too bad.
Good, good. Do you like Sir Les, or is it something that you're... Because I can't help but call you Sir Les. I was talking to Mrs. Matterface and putting in the calendar that I was doing this interview, and it just says Sir Les. And she asked me, have you done Sir Les yet? Do people call you that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't, when they see me, call me Sir Les, and a lot of people actually think I am a sir, which is quite funny, and I have to quickly remind and say, look, no, I'm not a sir. It was a nickname that I was given. I've been called a lot worse in my time, so I will take the name Sir Les.
I imagine you're busy nowadays being technical director, so there's not much time for reflection, but overall, how would you describe your career?
Well, how would I describe it? Probably didn't win as much as I would have liked to have done. But I look back on my career and I feel satisfied to a degree of what I went through and what I did.
What sort of number nine stroke forward stroke striker would you say you were?
I was one that could play up front on my own because I could hold the ball up. I could run in behind. I could win. I could play in a two because I could win flick-ons and I could work off another centre-forward. So I would say, looking back, if you look at a traditional number nine who could head it, who could hold it up, who could bring people into a game, I'd have thought that was me.
You were Newcastle's number nine until Alan Shearer came along. Did you give that shirt up easily?
There was no row about it. We was heading to the Far East for pre-season. I was in the airport. Kevin Keegan pulled me and he said to me, "Oh, listen, I just need to have a word with you before you jump on the plane." So I went into this little alcove with him and he said to me, "Look, I'm going to try and sign Alan Shearer. I think we're close to signing Alan Shearer." And I said, "Fantastic." And he goes, "The reason I'm pulling you, because I want you to know that once I sign him, you're going to hear loads of reports in the newspapers and stuff that your time's numbered at Newcastle and you're going to be leaving and blah, blah, blah." But he said, "That's nothing could be further from the truth. I'm one of the few that believe that you two could play together. I'm not trying to do this to prove anybody wrong. I just know that you can play together. So that's why I'm doing it." I said, "Okay, I really appreciate it." And so he said to me, I said, it'll be amazing for us. It's, you know, be icing on the cake." So I went to walk away and he went, "Oh, just one other thing." So I said, "What's that?" So he said, "Alan's asked, could he have the number nine shirt?" And I said, "And what did you say?" And he said, "Well, I said, I'd ask Les." I said, you said you'd ask me." So I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you know, Alan's worn the number nine all his career." I said, "Well, I've done it as well." And he said, "Oh, I didn't realise that." I said, "Okay, no problem."
And I said, well, look, listen, the truth is, the mere fact that you've asked me about it means you want him to have it. I understand where he's coming from. You know, he's grown up as a Newcastle supporter, number nine, as the iconic shirt at Newcastle. So I had no qualms with Alan asking him about the shirt. I'd have probably done the same thing myself. His boyhood hero, Jackie Milburn, wanted to wear that number nine shirt. So I said, the mere fact that you've asked me means you want him to have it. So you're the manager of Newcastle United. If you want that, that's what you got to do. And that was it. And then there was all these rumours that came out afterwards that I asked for the number 99, I asked for the number 69, I asked for all these ridiculous things. The one thing I did do was I went to the kit man and I said to him, what's the next available shirt? I said, I didn't want to take anybody else's shirt. What's the next available shirt? He said to me, he came up with some numbers. And I remember he said 21, which I quite like the idea of, and 23. And I was a Michael Jordan fan back in the day. So I said, I'll go for 23. And then the board came back and said, well, no, they want me to have a number between 1 and 11. I said, well, I had that. You took it off me. He said, what are you asking me for? Why are you saying that you want me to have 1 and 11? And then it materialised that Lee Clark was supposed to be leaving to go to Sunderland. And so the number 10 was going to become available. And that's how I ended up in the number 10 shirt. But there was no real arguments about it. It was only when they... when they said to me about a number between 1 and 11, and I said what I said.
To be a number 9, to be a number 10, whatever it is, as a striker, a centre forward, what do you have to be? Do you have to be a little bit selfish, but also aware of everybody else that's in your team?
Yeah, I think people look to you, depending on the type of the centre forward. They look to you to score goals. So there's a selfishness in you that wants to score goals. There's a selfishness in you that, you know, you want that supply. You need to be on the end of things that come in the box. There's an expectation that goes with that. So, you know, sometimes, as well as being selfish, you can come across as being quite arrogant as well at times.
Do you need to have those sort of personality traits? You need to be broad enough to carry that, though. I mean, I'm not saying you have to be arrogant, but you have to have that self-belief. Otherwise, there'd be strikers that, you know, just wilt under the pressure.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. I think if you look through history, that most of the good and great strikers that have come out of this country or in world football have always had that streak of selfishness in them. And when you're going through a phase in your career where things are not going as well, you start thinking about it. At the moment you bring thought into the process, you lose your rhythm. But centre forwards do things instinctively when they're in front of goal, and they'll take shots from places where people think, well, what are you doing? But when you're in that mode and in that frame of mind, you'll take those pot shots. And sometimes they'll go in, sometimes they'll go 10 foot over the bar, but no one ever go because they know that's what you do.
And did you back yourself? Were you one of those that really backed yourself? You weren't ever afraid at any point to justify why you'd done something to a manager, to a coach or to a teammate?
No. And like I said, I never got into a situation. I always remember playing with Teddy at Spurs, and we said to each other, we'd never ever go at each other for having a shot from wherever we had a shot from, because at the time of doing it, you believed that you was going to score. That was a centre-forward's mentality. And I think most managers, if you'd taken a shot and there was a pass on, they might have gone, did you see, blah, blah, blah, and you'd go, no. Because the truth is, you probably wouldn't have.
Have to be single-minded.
Yeah.
Let's warm you up with a couple of quick-fire questions, if possible. Get a sense of who Sir Les Ferdinand really is. What was your favourite goal?
Well, favourite goal. One that springs to mind is my first goal for Newcastle United.
Yeah, Newcastle have the chance to cruise their way through. And Ferdinand's off on a major run here. Ferdinand, he's round the keeper. Ferdinand, what a tremendous goal for Les Ferdinand, who opens his account and St James's Park erupts. And Les says it in style.
My first game at St James's Park, there'd been a lot gone on in the summer of me going there. It probably weren't one of my best goals, but it was probably one of my favourites, because that going in the back of the net and seeing the euphoria from the crowd at seeing their number 9 score on the opening day of the season always lives in the back of my mind. It always puts a smile on my face, because it was then I realised what that number 9 meant to those supporters.
What was the most important goal that you scored?
Well, when I first got into the QPR side, I remember playing against Luton on the AstroTurf. Don Howe was the manager and we were in trouble. We was in real trouble. And we were down near the relegation zone. We might have actually been in the bottom three. And I remember scoring two goals at Luton. That sent me on a run of scoring sort of like seven goals in the last nine games, I think it was. That was probably the most important goal because it kind of like kick-started me into really feeling like I belonged at QBR.
Who was your favourite strike partner?
Alan Shearer was probably the one I enjoyed playing most with.
Who was your childhood hero? Who did you grow up looking towards and thinking, he's my inspiration, I want to be like that guy?
Muhammad Ali.
Last night I cut the light off in my bedroom, hit the switch, was in the bed before the room was dark.
Incredible.
Fast.
Incredible.
And you, George Foreman, all of you chumps are going to bow when I whoop him. All of you. I know you got him. I know you got him picked, but the man's in trouble. I'm going to show you how great I am.
Back in the day, I wasn't. There weren't a lot of black players playing in the time of sort of like Muhammad Ali. When you looked at Muhammad Ali and what he was doing and what he was saying, you're thinking, well, that's unbelievable. And, you know, the first sort of like black players I saw playing on a regular basis was probably, you know, Cyril Regis, Laurie Cunningham and Brendan Batson at West Bromwich Albion at the time. And up until then, I mean, I had no thought of being a professional footballer.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more.
Ferdinand has the shot. Ferdinand scores! Les Ferdinand brings Queen's Park Rangers back into it at 3-2. A wonder strike from the QPR striker. And Man United could do nothing about that.
You played under four different managers in your decade, nearly a decade at Queen's Park Rangers, where it all really started for you. Who out of Jim Smith, Trevor Francis, Don Howe and Jerry Francis got the best out of you?
Jerry, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, I thought Don was a fantastic coach. He was probably up there with the best coaches I've worked with, Don. But myself and Don had a clash of personalities that meant we didn't see eye to eye. So Jerry would be the one who put an arm around me. Jerry knew how to get the best out of me. He was the one who came through the door, put an arm around me. And I didn't realise at the time I was one of those players that needed the manager to put his arm around me and say, listen, you're going to be my number nine going forward. You know, Jerry came through the door, said to me, I see you playing for England. And I thought to myself, I ain't even playing for QPR at the moment, so I don't know how you see me playing for England. But he did. And he worked with me, and he worked with me, and he worked with me. And, you know, yeah, so for me, he's probably, if I say the best manager at QPR, probably the best manager I worked with in my career.
You say you weren't even in the QPR team. I suppose, in a sense, you were a bit of a late bloomer, weren't you? For a guy who went on to be an international footballer and score 100 goals in the Premier League or more, 22 when you really got a proper run in the QPR first team.
You know, I joined QPR at 19. I came out of non-league at 19. May was the end of the season and I joined QPR around the Easter time. And so there was like a month or so of the season to go and I managed to get on the bench for a couple of games. The next season was a bit of a blur for me. I didn't really get myself into the side. I had a few injuries. And I think that was just coming out and on the league and getting used to being a professional footballer. And then the opportunity came to go to Turkey. And then it was going out to Turkey at 21 that really gave me the belief that I could play professional footballer. That was my, I always say to people, that was my apprenticeship. I never did an apprenticeship as a young man in professional football. But going out to Turkey was the making of me, as a player and as a man as well.
Ali, Ferdinand ve top ağlarda gol 3-0. Ferdinand Carlos'u mağlup ediyor. Queen's Park Rangers'tan gelen bir İngiliz futbolcu.
Beşiktaş, not the easiest place to go to. I mean, you're in the heart of Istanbul. Yeah. It's quite a lively set of rivalries that you've got going on there. You say it sort of toughened you up a little bit. You did fantastic. I mean, you scored 14 goals in 24 games. Did you hit the ground running straight away?
I did. At the start of every season, they had a thing called the President's Cup, which was a match which was played between Fenerbahce, Galatasaray and Beşiktaş, who were the three Istanbul teams at the time. And it was just a little competition. And I remember scoring against Fenerbahce in my first game. And then against the Galatasaray, and everyone was like, who's this kid all of a sudden come from nowhere and is doing this? And but back then, Turkish football had a real high regard for English football. So coming out of first division side, which would have been the equivalent of a Premier League side today, They had a high regard for me, even though I'd come out just playing reserve team football, you know. So I went there, and it was like I said, it was the making of me.
You scored bucket loads of goals eventually for Queen's Park Rangers when you did get into the team, and everyone thought that you were moving on at the end of every season in the early 90s. Did you enjoy that speculation?
Back in the day, you'll remember this as well, you could have been at a QPR, you could have been at a Luton, you could have been at one of these teams who, and as a centre forward, you start the season as a winger, whatever position you played, you started the season really well. The team got off to a flyer and everyone was doing well. And within a couple of months of you starting off that season and the team doing that well, someone would come and nick the centre forward because they could. People started saying this ain't right because it's unsettling the team and it's putting us in problems and blah, blah. Hence why, in the end, they brought these transfer windows in. Because I always remember myself and Andy Sinton were touted every year as they're leaving QPR, they're going here and they're going there. And, you know, there were occasions where I was sat in my dad's house on a Sunday and, you know, he opened the door to me and I'd walk in and he'd go, what are you doing here? So I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, if you read this newspaper, you're in Liverpool at the moment, or you're in this place, like, you know what I mean? I said, well, I know nothing about it, Dad. So, yeah, I mean, I stayed at QPR for as long as I felt I was learning. In hindsight, when I look back at my career, had I left QPR a year or two earlier, would I have achieved what I wanted to achieve? And that was perhaps winning more things. But, you know, I left when I felt I'd got to a point where I wasn't learning anymore.
And 92-93, this QPR team was the top team in London. As I remember working for a radio station, Capital Gold, and listening to Jonathan Pearce, and it was one of the things he kept banging on and on and on and on about.
Yeah, and you know, because we are QPR, we weren't going to get the credit we deserve for that. When you think of the teams that were in London at the time, and, you know, your Arsenals, your West Hams, your Tottenhams, you know, Chelsea's and stuff like that, and we were top London club, it was some achievement for a club of our size. And if you looked at our wages bill compared to all the rest of them, we would have been well below it.
Still Gillespie and Ferdinand. He escaped the marking completely, and the finish once again was so decisive. And from being a goal down, Newcastle have turned it round. They lead 2-1. Both goals from Les Ferdinand.
You went to Newcastle with Kevin Keegan, £6 million, which at the time was big, big money.
Yeah.
Some might feel the pressure. The number 9 on the back of the black and white jersey, it's weighed heavy on shoulders of many others, but you thrived. Why do you think that was?
Because as I said, when I left QPR, I had no doubt in my ability. I had no doubt wherever I went, I was going to go and score goals. You know, when I worked with Tim and Chris at Tottenham, and this may sound arrogant, it may sound flash, I don't know, but I said to them, I used to sit in the changing rooms before a game thinking, I know I'm going to score today. I'd got myself to that level that I felt. And, you know, if you spoke to Alan, if you spoke to Andy Cole, if you spoke to Ian Wright, if you spoke to any of the strikers that I've just mentioned who were around at that time, I'm sure they went through periods in their career where they felt, yeah, no problem, I'll score today. You know, and I used to say to, you know, I'd go out and I'd say to them, well, just get the ball in the box. Just get the ball in the box, I'll score for you. And it wasn't, and like I said to him, it may sound arrogant, it may sound flashy, it just wasn't. It was that you felt you'd got yourself to in such good condition that you felt it didn't matter what the circumstances, you were going to score.
That season was the best of your career, the 29-goal season. It's the season of 12 points clear. It's the one that got away for Newcastle. Despite your belief, why do you think the title slipped out of Newcastle's hands, having had time to reflect on it now?
I think a couple of things. I think too many of us lost form. There weren't many in that changing room that won things. I think Peter Beardsley, and I think David Ginola had won something in Paris before coming to Newcastle. But other than that, there wasn't many in our changing rooms that had won things. So when we lost that first 3 points, rather than a thing of, damn chaps, we've lost 3 points here, we've got to make sure this doesn't happen again, we've got to get back on our mettle and all that, it was a little bit more like, that's all right, we've lost 3 points, but we've got a game in hand and we're 9 points clear. We get that three, we win that the game, we'll win our game in hand and we'll be 12 points clear again, rather than a real sense of disappointment in losing those 3 points. And again, I think as well, as a group, we didn't really have any tactics. The tactics were, I say we didn't have any tactics, our tactics were you score two, we'll score three. And as we know in the Premier League, that you know, there's got to be games that you win 1-0. We just didn't have that. We were probably a little bit too gung-ho.
Barnes, Rush, Barnes. Still John Barnes, Collymore closing in!
Did you ever sort of bring that up with Kevin towards the end?
Because I loved it as a centre forward. You're never going to bring it up, but you know, it's only now when you sit back and analyse and go for it, or you think, you know, because he gave us all that belief. We all had that belief that yeah, we'll done that. If they score, we'll score two. Don't worry. Look who we got in the team. We'll score two.
I mentioned it to him once, probably ill-advisedly. And he really didn't like the idea of the tactics being described in that way. He got quite cross about it. And I wonder now, having listened to you, whether or not that is because it's still, even, I don't even know how many years it is, 25 years on,
yeah,
it still affects him.
Yeah, no, without a shadow of a doubt. And, you know, when he left the club the next year, you know, most of us believed that he hadn't recovered from the fact that we hadn't won the league that the year before.
You and Alan, when you did play together, were almost unstoppable, Alan Shearer and you. You scored 50 goals in 84 games personally for Newcastle. In 96-97, you scored 49 between you. Am I right in saying, and after what you've already told me, I probably am, that you used to give Alan a little pep talk before you kicked off?
We'd stand in the centre circle. He might say it to me, I might say it to him, and say, shall we terrorise him today, Al? And he would say, you go, Len, should we have a go at him today? We go, yeah, okay, come on then. And we just enjoyed our football. We enjoyed playing together. I knew what I was going to get from him. He knew what he was going to get from me. And if I weren't quite giving him what he wanted, he was down the back of my throat. He was like, are you? Blah, blah, blah, blah. And vice versa, you know. And it just clicked for us.
Gillespie's corner. Up goes Ferdinand. Shearer. And Ferdinand off the line. But it squeezed in, and Shearer's got it this time.
Did you become good friends off the pitch as well as on it?
The great thing about that Newcastle side was I'd say that we were all great friends off the pitch. And, you know, everyone says to me, what was Alan like? What was Alan? And I say, like, a load of the players I worked with, he was a great fellow, you know, and I still speak to Alan today. I wouldn't say we were great friends off of it, but I would say we were good. We were decent enough friends off the pitch.
Was there competition between the two of you as to who could get the most goals?
I think both of us, we always used to say the same thing. The one thing we wanted to do was we wanted Newcastle to win games of football. And I think that's why we got on so well. I wouldn't go on the pitch thinking, I need to score more than Alan. Or, you know, I'm sure Alan went on the pitch. I'm not sure if he felt the same. But my goal was for the team to win. And if I was in a position where I could slide Alan in and he scored a hat-trick, that was all well and good for the team. Of course, I'm a centre-forward, so I want to score goals. So I always put myself in positions where I could score goals. But I wasn't sitting there thinking, oh, I need to show everyone that I could score more goals than Alan.
Why did you leave?
Again, I think a few clubs had come in and Newcastle needed to raise some money. At the time, I think they signed me when I was 28 and they paid £6 million. They had 2 years out of me. Obviously, Keegan had gone, Dalglish had come in and they wanted to raise money. My name had been touted about a little bit. And in the end, I agreed to Tottenham, made the bid, and they accepted the bid. And then I remember coming down to London on a Friday to do a medical, and Newcastle were going to Everton Goodison Park to play in the Umbro tournament, and Alan broke his ankle. And I remember sitting in a restaurant on a Saturday night, my agent calling me saying, Les, Alan's broken his ankle. And my first thought, I've got to get on the phone and call him and see if he's okay. And I went, oh, thanks for letting me know. I'll give him a call now. And as I went to put the phone down, my agent went, hey, hang on, Newcastle need you to come back, want you to come back. And I went, what? And there was a lot of backing and forthing because everyone knows I didn't want to leave Newcastle at the time, but because of the way things had gone, because of the way things had happened, meant this came to light. And I always remember them saying, they want you to come back. I went, oh, they want me to come back now, do they? A little while ago, they were saying, no, it's all right, you can go. So anyway, I probably left more out of pride than what was probably the right thing for my footballing career.
That is fascinating, isn't it? That they called you back and said, no, we need you now.
Yeah.
That conversation, did you have it with Kenny Dalglish?
No. The thing was, because they'd accepted the bid, they weren't able to speak to me. They could only speak to me through my agent because they'd accepted the bid from Tottenham. So I was scheduled to go meet Tottenham on the Sunday at Alan Sugar, and I was going around Alan Sugar's house, but they came down to my agent's house in North London and had a meeting with the agent and said, well, look, this is what we've put on the table for Les. This is what he gets if he comes back. You know, if he comes back, he'll be a hero and this, and this. And I remember speaking to Alan in the morning and I said to him, look, Al, the truth is, if I go to Spurs and I like what Alan's got to say, I'm going to sign there. And he went, I'd love you to come back, but I understand why you'd do that. And he said, I'd probably do the same. And I always say to people now that I probably made this decision based out of pride rather than out of what was the best thing for my footballing career.
Plenty more to come on Up Front with Les Ferdinand as he tells us what it was like to share a dressing room with Jurgen Klinsmann.
And I could remember he was in a foul mood and no one could understand it. And I was sitting there thinking, yeah, I understand it. I know why you're in a foul mood.
This is Up Front with Les Ferdinand and me, Sam Atterface, on TalkSport.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. There's a lot more to those 90 minutes than what goes down on the pitch. With the latest odds, form guides and expert opinions, you'll know the score with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com, 18 plus, begambleaware.org. T's and C's apply.
Back for another one of those block-rocking beats.
Skill from Beardsley, Gillespie, danger here, good save and turned in by Ferdinand, and that is the record for Les Ferdinand. It's the eighth consecutive match in which he has scored, and that means he has set a new Newcastle United scoring record.
You've been on the back pages a fair bit. Strikers usually are the ones that get the headlines. How did you cope with the attention, especially in a goldfish bowl like Newcastle?
This is where Kevin Keegan was fantastic for me. When I went to Newcastle, I sat down before I got there, before I agreed to sign and everything, he said to me, look, the one thing I will say to you, son, he said, is look, there's no hiding place. And I was like, what? He said, in London, you can get away, you can go places, you can do things, because there's so many famous people in London. You know, people are not really bothered in London. You can go about. He said, Newcastle, everything's about football. So he said to me, what do you want to do? So I said, what do you mean? He said, is there anything you'd like to do? I said, well, look, I'd like to learn how to cook. I'd like to learn how to play the saxophone. I'd like to learn how to ride a motorbike. And he went, I might be able to deal with two of them, but I'm not sure I could deal with a third one. And I went, what was that? He said, well, I'll ride on a motorbike. So I went, okay. He said, but let's think about it. So I got there and I learned to ride a motorbike. I learned to play the saxophone and I learned how to cook. So, you know, that took up my time. And I was really fortunate. I really, really was fortunate, Sam, because in the 2 years that I was there, okay, the first year we should have won the title. But for 95% of the season, the place was on and up in terms of the football that we played and where we was in the league. So I didn't really see a bad time there, if that. You know, apart from us not winning the league, obviously, yeah, everyone was depressed and disappointed. But after that, after the season was over, I came back to London. So I didn't see the doom and the gloom that was around the town, if that makes sense. And then obviously,
the start of the next season, everyone's buzzing again because the season's about to start and blah, they've missed football and we go again. And in 2 years, we finished second in the league twice. So, like I said, it was always an upward curve there. I never really experienced a bad time. So I was very, very fortunate in terms of that. The football was that good that, you know, people were enjoying what they were coming to watch week in, week out on most occasions. So I was able to get away with a bit more. And then it was there that Keegan had put something out about the fact that, you know, I was on my own and he'd done some, you know, like fans forum sort of thing. And he said, like, you know, I'd learned to do these things. And then someone came on to me about saying, look, I know you're trying to keep yourself busy. Would you like to learn how to fly a helicopter? And I went, I've gone from motorbikes to even dating. I'm saying even more dangerous than learning how to fly a helicopter. So I went, yeah, it took my attention and kind of like got into it back then. And before I had my lesson there in Newcastle, I came back to London and signed for Tottenham. But it was something that was in my head now and I just continued to do it.
And you become a pilot?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
I mean, do you have, is it similar sort, I know it sounds stupid, is it a similar sort of mindset? Do you have to be a certain, you have to have a certain level of confidence, of not arrogance, but of self-belief?
I think first and foremost, you sort of want to do whatever it is that you've set out to do. And for me, I wanted to, you know, once I'd had the first lesson, I was like, nah, this is something I need to do. I want to pass my test here. So you put your concentration into it. I mean, there's seven exams you got to do along the way. Learn about air law, meteorology, human biology, radio tech. There's all sorts of things that you got to learn along the way. And so I just got my head down and I sort of like, you know, I was traveling away to away games and in the hotel I was studying. I was studying for my exams rather than doing anything else, like, you know.
Do you have your own helicopter? How often do you fly it? And who's your most famous passenger?
I had my own helicopter for a bit. And basically, I used to just go. I mean, when I played at Bolton, I used to fly to Barton Airport in the mornings, leave the helicopter there. Again, Sam Allardyce was brilliant with me. He'd say, right, okay, we're playing in London on Friday. You go back to London on the Wednesday or the Thursday. I'd fly back to London and I'd meet them in the hotel on the Friday. So, you know, I just used it when I had my own helicopter. I've sold it now, but when I had my own helicopter, I just used it ad hoc, really. And probably I weren't using it enough, and that's why in the end I ended up getting rid of it.
No famous passengers then?
I had Jamie Redknapp and Tim Sherwood in it. They were doing a bit for a magazine. I remember flying back from the last cup final in Cardiff, and I was coming back, and I had Jeff Shreves and Jamie in the helicopter, and we had to land at Bryce Norton because the weather came in and it was that bad that I didn't, you know, the one good thing about the machine, and if you're sensible, when there's bad weather, you just put it down on the ground, you find the field and you put it down on the ground. But when I was going through, I was speaking to Bryce and they said, look, you can't really go any further because loads of the helicopters have landed at Elstree and other places because they couldn't continue their journey. So I said, can we come in there? And they said, yeah. So I think they were a little bit nervous because obviously the weather was coming in, but managed to land it at Bryce Norton with not too much else. And we had to get a cab the rest of the way home.
You were a great goal scorer, but there's always another side to it, isn't there? The times when things don't go as planned, the goal drought, or when a move doesn't go as expected. How do you deal with that? And do you think that the first couple of seasons at your boyhood club Spurs fall into that category?
Yeah, I think, I mean, my first couple of seasons at Spurs, I think, obviously, I was transitioning from a club who saw themselves as a big club in Newcastle, and they did everything that I expected a big club to do. And I always remember when I was at QPR, you know, Ray Wilkins used to speak to me, and Ray was one of my biggest mentors. I always call him the late great Ray Wilkins. He used to say to me, "When you go to a big club, you'll understand because they do things in a big way, and you'll see their mentality, and you'll understand." I used to go, okay. And then when I went to Newcastle, although Newcastle, and it all depends how you describe a big club. Is it someone that wins loads of stuff? Is it the supporters? Whatever it is. But, you know, I saw Newcastle as a big club. They had a big club mentality. Everything they did was kind of like top drawer. It was like, and how I describe it, it's like going to the post house or going to the Ritz. you know, and they did everything like they was at the Ritz, you know. And when I went to Spurs, it was probably the opposite of that. Although I'd seen Spurs as a big club all my life, they were probably the opposite of that. But I kind of like knew they were trying to build and get the club back to where, to former glories, and it was going to take time.
You won the League Cup with Spurs in 1999, and, yep. and for a club, as you say, it was trying to rebuild and to make itself bigger again and doesn't win that many trophies, it must have been quite a special day. I mean, it wasn't a classic cup final, but it was a special day.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, as a kid, you dream about playing at Wembley, although you do dream about playing in Wembley in the FA Cup final. But any final, but playing at Wembley, just being there and, you know, you remember sort of like watching the FA Cup as a kid and watching them at the hotel, getting on the coach and all the things they did, all right, the lead up all the way to Wembley and then watching the game. And, you know, OK, we were doing this in the League Cup, and it was always a bit strange because the League Cup's always played before the end of the season. But still, it was a cup final and it was at Wembley, and we managed to win it. As you said, it wasn't a classic game, but we managed to win it. So it was nice to go up them stairs and live a boyhood dream.
Eventually, you hit it off on the pitch with Jürgen Klinsmann, didn't you? What was that partnership like?
Yeah, I mean, Jürgen, you know, because it was our time together was so short, you always, you know, always, I say forget, but, you know, when people talk to me about the great strikers I've played with, you know, because Jürgen weren't just a great striker, he was a great fella as well. When you talk about strikers, when their arrogance and that selfishness, I always remember Jürgen. And as nice as a fella as he was off the pitch, and he was a great fella off the pitch, I always remember coming in a game that we won at White Hart Lane, and I think we won 3-1 or something like that, and he hadn't scored, and he was in a foul mood, and no one could understand it. But being a centre forward, I could understand it. It was probably more than three, because that's why he had the ump, because it was more than three. He hadn't scored. And I could remember he was in a foul mood and no one could understand it. And I was sitting there thinking, yeah, I understand it. I know why you're in a foul mood. It's the fact that we won, and we won by so many goals, and you haven't scored. You know what I mean? And that was just, you know, that trait we talk about centre forwards having. But he was great to play with. He came to the club and we were in a real precarious position at the time of him coming to the club. You know, he came through the door, and he was one of those players, when he comes through the door, there's a bit of an aura around him that you think, yeah, we don't mind him coming to help us because we know he is going to help us. Do you know what I mean? And him and Nicola Bertie, and we managed to stave off that being near the bottom of the table and survived in the Premier League.
Ferdinand takes it on himself. Now, Klinsmann for a fourth! They're walking in the Klinsmann wonderland.
There was a second League Cup final for Spurs, wasn't there? And it was one of those days where you get chance after chance after chance. And you come up against a goalkeeper who just keeps making saves. You ended up losing that final. Did you have to walk away from that final thinking to yourself, he's just had an absolute worldie, you can't do anything about it?
Yeah, I mean, we was, you know, there was chance after chance, myself, Gus Poirier, there were so many chances in the game. And even when we beat the goalkeeper, we kind of like hit the bar or the post. It was, you know, and then you get to a stage in the game where you start thinking, we just ain't going to win this today. We ain't going to have this off today. Do you know what I mean? And you walk away from it and you think back of the chances you had, and you think in most games you score half of those chances, but you just weren't to be in that game. And we've seen loads of games like it where, you know, a team is out there and you say they could have been out there for another 90 minutes and they would never have scored, you know.
And they've got the quick break, and he's away, Les Ferdinand. Can he make it two? Oh, yes, a classic break. And England may have put this World Cup tie beyond Georgia in the first 35 minutes.
Alan Shearer was the perfect foil for you at Newcastle. Were you surprised that you weren't used more together for the national team, and it wasn't replicated more for England?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we sort of like our time at Newcastle together came sort of like the back end of Terry Venables' reign, and we, you know, when I went to Spurs, I was now 30, 31. So I knew then the chances of us playing together, and I think Glenn Hoddle tried to do it a few times, but before that,
That the season where I, you said, you know, my best season at Newcastle was scored 29 goals, a PFA Player of the Year. We go to the Euros and I don't play in one game, 1 minute of any game. And, you know, you tend to look around, if you look around Europe and world football and you say that don't happen in no other country in the world. Mm. Normally a player that's done that. I was up to like 20 goals before Christmas and I still weren't in the England side. I wasn't even in the squads. And then I think there was a big thing from the papers going, how comes this, you know, Les Ferdinand scoring all these goals and he's not in the England squad. And then I got back into the squad. I just don't believe I was, you know, Terry Venables' type of player. Myself, Andy Cole, we just weren't his types of player.
So you're in the Euro 96 squad, but didn't really get the opportunity to play. What was it like being in that squad when you knew that everything was going on around you? It was an iconic tournament. The whole nation is sort of, is almost smothering you because you're sort of hyper aware of everything because it's in this country, whereas other tournaments, maybe that wouldn't have been the case.
Yeah, and I think as well, if you remember back to 96, the coming into the tournament, the country was in a bit of a doldrum, but everybody got behind the national team. And, you know, it was the first time, I say to people, it was the first time I'd seen women at football before, but it was the first time I was seeing women coming from the office and going straight to a game. You know, just everybody got behind the team. And it was great to be part of that. And it was great to feel that. But if you're not playing out on the pitch, you do not feel part of the team. And you do not feel part of what's going on.
And you felt like that?
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
What about the 98 World Cup?
I mean, the 98 World Cup was pretty ironic as well, because I've got to be honest, because of my injuries and stuff that I had at Spurs that year, I didn't expect to go. I had a recurring Achilles problem that kept coming back to me. And in the end, it was after the 98 World Cup that I had the operation on it. But I wasn't expecting to go because my form hadn't been great and I'd had a few injuries throughout the season. And then Glenn had got in contact and brought me back into the squad. I was in the squad and I was training and he's going, look, I'm going to put a B international on just to get you some game time because I know you haven't had a lot of game time. And we played, myself and Matt Letizia played in a B international at Loftus Road against Russia. And I think that was the last B international that was ever played just to try and get some game time. And even leading up to it, I was like, nah, you know, Dion Dublin was doing well, Wright was doing them. But then I think Wright broke his ankle, did something to his ankle just before the competition. And I think that heralded me into that place. So I wasn't expecting to play. And I always remember, and it's quite ironic, we was playing against Argentina and I was warming up behind the goal because you couldn't warm up alongside, you had to go behind the goal and warm up. So I went to warm up. Glenn Rhoda had called me, said, oh, you're going on, come. So I ended up jogging back with Glenn Rhoda, got my shirt on and got everything ready. Glenn was just telling me, blah, blah, blah. And as he's telling me, I'm standing on the side of the pitch and David Beckham kicks out at Simone.
Wait a minute, he's taking another card out for Beckham. It's a red card for David Beckham. Oh, no. So Beckham is out of the game.
And Glenn looks at me and he says to me, Les, I need to put someone on that can play midfield and centre forward, which was obviously Paul Merson. Because Paul used to play as a 10 back then. And so he looked at me and like there was nothing I could say, do you know what I mean? All I remember is David's foot coming up and just clipping Simone and Simone going down like he'd been shot. And I was like, oh, no. Anyway, I was thinking, don't send him off. Then so it was, you know, obviously the referee sent him off and the rest is history. And so that tournament now, I look at it and I go, you know, well, look, I've gone to another tournament, not got on. But that was due to circumstances more than anything else. I was going on the pitch. I was ready. I had my shirt on. I was ready and I was being given my instructions. And then that happened and I just went, well, it's not meant to be.
When next time you see him, you can give him a bit of a verbal volley.
it's well forgotten now.
Later in your career, you found yourself at Leicester. You were 37 and still scoring goals in the Premier League. I think, were you their Player of the Year? That season. What did you do to maintain your fitness and sharpness for so long?
I have to sort of like look at Mickey Adams. When I went there, he said to me, look, you know, come have some fun with us and blah, blah, blah, blah, blah. And what they did, they tapered my training. So, you know, at 37, they knew I wasn't going to cut any corners. I was going to do whatever I needed to do to get myself fit enough to play football on a Saturday. And he liked what he saw.
So at the end of training, when there was all this running, you know, Mickey was very heavily into to running the squad. He would say no. And I said, Mick, we're the fittest team in the league. I always used to argue. I said, we're the fittest team in the league. And he goes, you don't need to do this, Les. And I went, well, I'm part of the lads. And if they're going to do it, I need to do it as well. He's going, no, I don't want you to do it. We can do something else with you. And to be fair, they tapered my training to make sure that I could play games on a Saturday, Tuesday, Monday, whatever it was that where the games were coming. And I always say to people say to me, how do you carry on playing football for as long as you did? It was because I loved playing football. I love scoring goals. I love being part of a team. And I still felt I could give something to a team.
Layoff is for Freund. Here's Shimica. There's some method in this from Leicester. Benjamin. Is it going in? And Ferdinand scores! Les Ferdinand makes it Leicester 1, Birmingham 0.
After being relegated with Leicester in that year, and as you said, scored, I ended up scoring, I think, 14 goals in 20-odd games again, I think it was something like that, somewhere around that figure. I always remember sort of like sitting at home thinking, right, that's it, I'm going to announce my retirement. And then Sam Allardyce gets in contact, and I meet Sam, and I said, listen, Sam, I really appreciate the offer, but I'm thinking that, you know, my time's over now, you know. And he went, no, your time's not over. And that was when I realised how sophisticated football had become, because Sam was able to give me all my stats of what I'd done the previous season, my running stats, my sprinting stats, my goals compared to this, that and the other. And he went, you still got too much to offer football to retire. And I went, try telling my body that. I said, my girlfriend, I'm going to wake up in the morning, my missus is saying to me, Les, please retire. And I said, I used to be like Superman. I'd get up and I'd get off the bed, and I'd walk, like, I'd be limping, I'd be doing this, that, and the other, and she'd go, she'd look at me, she'd go, let's just retire. And I'd go in the shower, and I'd just come out like a new man, like, you know, we'd be bouncing around. It was like Superman going in that telephone box and putting the cape on and coming back out. As soon as I come out of the shower, I was right and ready to go again, do you know what I mean? So, yeah, Sam persuaded me to play for another year, and but I didn't really get to play, hence why I left at Christmas time, because I said to him, if it was going to be my last year, I wanted to play. Which he was quite stunned by, because he went, you're earning good money, you're sitting on the bench, you're coming off. I said, Sam, if it's my last year, I don't want to sit on anyone's bench and earn money. I said, I want to play. You know, I've played all my career. I don't want to sit on anyone's bench and go, right, okay, yeah, I'm happy to earn this. And blah. And he, to be fair, he admired it. And that's why he let me go to Reading in the end, because I just still wanted to play football.
We started by opening the interview talking about you being nicknamed Sir Les. And you pointed out that you aren't actually a knight of the realm, but you were made an MBE in the 2005 Queen's Birthday Honours list.
Yeah.
How important is that honour to you?
I mean, when I always remember standing in the line, and I was listening to firefighters, I was listening to you know, policemen and people go up and what they were being honoured for, and I turned around and I said to a fireman, I feel like I'm not worthy of this. When I listened to you guys saving lives and this, that and the other, and he turned around and he said to me, Les, you've put smiles on faces of millions of people's faces year in, year out for donkey's years. He said, enjoy it. And it kind of like made me think of it in a different way. And yeah, obviously honoured to have that accolade and be given that MBE, and it was a nice day for me and my family.
At the end of these interviews, we've been sort of testing our number nines, our forwards. We call it the perfect hat trick. We sort of test to see how well you know yourself. Three questions, all about you. how well do you know yourself, do you reckon?
I'm going to go, I know myself really well, but then you're going to ask me the question and I ain't going to get one right.
No. You'll smash this, I'm sure of it. Sure. You won your first piece of silverware in Turkey whilst at Beşiktaş. It was the Turkish Cup final. Who did you beat on aggregate and what was the score?
We beat Fenerbahçe on aggregate, and if I'm not mistaken, the score was 3-1.
Correct. When you transferred to Newcastle for £6 million, Hayes got a sell-on fee. What did they do with the money?
They built a new clubhouse, and they called a room the Les Ferdinand room.
The Ferdinand suite.
With Ferdinand suite, yeah, that's it, yeah.
you scored the 10,000th goal of the Premier League era in December 2001. But who was it against? It was for Spurs. Who was it against?
Fulham.
It was indeed. Look, see, you absolutely smashed it like you did the rest of your career. You put them all away.
Davis. And a turn. Ferdinand! It's the 10,000th goal scored in the competition. And Les Ferdinand, one of the most prolific goal scorers in the Premier League, was in the right place at the right time to nick it home.
You've been listening to Upfront with Les Ferdinand and me, Sam Matterface. And if you missed any of the show or want to catch up, you can download the podcast from the TalkSport Game Day feed, available on Apple Podcasts, Acast and Spotify.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. The latest odds? We set them. Form guides? We've got them. Expert opinions? We share them. The best fans in the world deserve the best. Be match day ready before the whistle blows with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com. 18 plus. Be gambleaware.org. T's and C's apply.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.